with the latest on the corporate front, all the market trends, expert opinion, and sound business advice. It is your unique window into the business world, direct from the heart of China.
Hello and welcome to Biz Today. I'm Zhao Yang in Beijing. Coming up, we will have half an hour of business news and analysis. On today's show, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen wrapped up her visit to China. What are the highlights of the visits? And the U.S. Consumer Price Index rose 3.5% in March. What does the latest figure mean for the Federal Reserve's interest rate cuts in the future? And now let's begin with our top story. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has reiterated that Washington doesn't seek to decouple from China. Towards the end of her visit to China, Yellen said decoupling would bring catastrophic consequences given the close economic ties between the two countries. During her visit to China, Chinese Premier Li Qiang met with her. And the premier called on the U.S. to abide by the basic norms of the market economy, including fair competition and open cooperation, and refrain from turning economic and trade issues into political or security issues. So what are the highlights of Yellen's visit, and what does it mean for the China-U.S. relationship in the long run? For more on this, join us on the line now are Dr. Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation, and also Yan Liang, Professor of Economics, Willamette University. So, Dr. Zhou, how would you evaluate the outcomes of Janet Yellen's recent visit to China? What do you see are some of the most important focuses of her, you know, discussions with Chinese officials?
We know that Secretary Yellen came to China just to undertake the routine meetings with Chinese leaders or some officials of China. So I think that she has made it a very good use of these opportunities to exchange her well points with the Chinese officials and with the market. Before she left the United States, she attended several conferences to send some signals about what she is going to discuss with China about overcapacity, about some of this to do with the new energy industry. And also she is trying to see that she wants to reiterate the United States will not decouple from China. So actually that, you know, some kind of messages are combined, and that is heard by the market. So when she came here, I mean that there are plenty of time when she went to Guangzhou and also went to Beijing to meet with different peoples in the market, also from the government. I think it's a really nice opportunity to exchange the viewpoints about United States and China in such a very bumping years, because United States is under the election process. So many of the different informations are sent by the government and the market do not know which one is true, which one is not. So actually, I think it's a good opportunity to fulfill the commitments and also the consensus by the two leaders. They met in San Francisco last November, and it's a kind of a very important mechanism to trying to even improve or trying to implement two work groups on exchange of the information about the financial data and also about something to do with the financial crimes. I think it is a good signal that we have some of the consensus, but we still see that there are some disagreements about several topics. I think it's natural for both sides.
Mm-hmm. So, Yan, so what are your main takeaways from her engagement with the Chinese officials?
So I agree with Dr. Zhou. I think the fact that she returned to China just, you know, 9 months away from her last visit, I think that showcases, you know, how important the Chinese, U.S.-China relationships are for the Biden administration. And so Janet Yellen, as we know, you know, she's a pragmatic person. She is a technocrat. She does not like, you know, the politicians that are facing sort of electoral votes kind of pressures. So she does not talk hawkish. She is trying to deliver the message that, you know, the U.S.-China relationships are very important for both countries and for the rest of the world. So I think in that regard, her visit is a positive sign, and it helps to stabilize the relationships She definitely also talked about some of the cooperations on climate change, that issues in developing countries, also counter illicit finance and anti-narcotics. So all of these are, I think, areas that we can see more cooperation. But at the same time, of course, the main message that she sent about the so-called industrial overcapacity, which we can definitely talk about, I personally think this is really a red herring. I think all of these are, false accusations. But again, I think despite, this sort of the concerns that she sounded, I think it's still a positive, a visit, and that would help to really stabilize the relationships at the United States going into the election later this year.
So Dr. Zhou, so Yellen emphasized that the U.S. does not seek to decouple from China. So how do you think we should interpret this statement?
I think that, the statement is rational because, United States and China, we are such a big economies. And I don't think there is one reason that these countries can do everything separately. And maybe it's not a problem of willingness, it's about a problem of abilities. I think that China has, supplied the United States with so many products, and we also benefit by the import from United States. Actually, in the past decades, the history has improved, has proved that, this kind of inter-elections relations have made it both sides benefited from. So, in the future, there are still so many challenges. We are seeing that the world is changing and a lot of new requirements are pushed on the cooperation between different countries. And for China and United States, it is a really good opportunity for us to try to think about how can we handle this problem, together instead of just trying to decouple from each other. So actually, I think that, in the past several years, we see that there are some messages sent by the US media or some of the officials that United States should decouple from China, but they also fear about the pain because of the CPI, about the inflation, also a lot of a shortage of supplies. And it's not only about the amount of the goods that they can buy from the world market, but also about the quality, about how fragile if the retailers want to import things from other countries, and that made their decisions much short term, and it's a really tarfing decision for them to make to make it a stable supply to the market.
And so, during her visit, Janet Yellen expressed concerns regarding the so-called industrial overcapacity. And industrial policies, we see a tendency coming from governments all over the world to strengthen that, including the United States. So how do you see the perspectives about how the Biden administration looking at EVs and solar panels from China?
Right. So I think you're absolutely right. I think the Biden administration is seeing China's growing competitiveness in EV, solar panel, wind turbines, and many of these green products and green energies with a sort of wary eye. They worry that the Chinese competitiveness is going to undercut their own economy. And as a result, I think they sounded this alarm about the overcapacity issue. But again, I don't think the evidence or the data really backed up their claims. When we look at, the so-called overcapacity, we're looking at three main indicators. One is we look at the capacity utilization. So basically looking at, how much we're actually using our productive capacity. China, 76% is our, capacity utilization rate. The United States is 78%, which is just a little bit, 2 percentage points higher than China's. So there's no really, underutilized capacity for that matter. And when you look at the inventory, for example, China's overall industrial inventory remains low under that 50 benchmark. So was the U.S. And then lastly, we look at industrial profits. And actually, when you look at the first 2 months, the industrial profits was a very healthy 10.2% growth year on year in the first 2 months of this year. So based on all three different indicators, we're not seeing the overwhelming evidence of the so-called industrial, overcapacity. And of course, I think accusing China for implementing, industrial policy, I think that is just hypocritical because we know the United States has recent years, passed three very important industrial policies, right? The Inflation Reduction Act, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, and the Science and Chips Act. So all of these are trying to promote their specific industries. So I think it's just, in a way, double standards when U.S. is accusing China for, you know, using industrial policies when they themselves actually are also implementing them.
Mm. And Dr. Zhou, so talking about American EV producers or EV makers such as Tesla in China, they have one of the largest factories in China. So how do you see the overall picture of China-US trade relations regarding EVs?
Actually, you are right. You know, when Tesla came to China, it is the first FDIs on the automobiles, which has 100% of the shares for Tesla. So it's a kind of a very important innovation, even for China's FDI policies. So we opened that sector to Tesla, and that is also, you know, contributed to our flourish of the different EV makers in China. Well, for China, I think that the reason why we have very strong abilities on the producing of the EVs is not only based on this kind of automobile basis, but also about our market, because we have a very huge market and the government is trying to work very hard to improve the infrastructure on the, you know, EV related sectors. So this market has made it happen that China's EVs are so competitive. Well, many other countries are also trying to increase their abilities on importing the EVs or make the EVs by themselves. Actually, United States has imported not many EVs from China. It's a very small number compared with other countries in the world. So I would say that if United States, especially Biden administration, if they continue to try to fulfill their commitments in the climate change, they have to change the usage of the energy, because the United States is a country on the wheels. It has a very large amount of demand on the fossil energy, but if they want to emit less carbons, they need to use the EVs. It's actually one of the possible opportunities for both sides to continue with the trade and the investment together. So I would say if United States government do not put so many restrictions, do not so send some very bad message to the market will be very active in accepting China's EVs in different kind of demands.
Mm. And Dr. Zhou, so the Chinese Premier Li Qiang urged the U.S. to view the issue of production capacity objectively from a market-oriented and global perspective. So how to understand China's perspective on this?
Yeah, actually, that is was an opinion I observed from Ian's points, that the United States is trying to using more industrial policies to interfere with the market. Actually, it's not only about the money. It's not about the cost that companies, if they put investment in the United States, get some money back. It is also about the leading, about the information, about the trust. Because some of the companies, they want to make a longer term of investment, and EV is definitely one of them. If they have to consider about for the next 5 years or 10 years, maybe they need to consider about the policies steadiness. So I would say that for both sides, we should try to respect the market, because the market is very important and very strong in the deciding of the, you know, relations between different stakeholders. Well, the market are really, you know, improved in the past decades when the WTO has provided a platform for all the members to fulfill their commitments of open, of non-discriminant. But now, if some of the countries are trying to do that by themselves to decide the rules unilaterally, I don't think it will give a very clear signal to the market. So for Premier Li Qiang, I think that he is trying to deliver this message. We want to cooperate with the United States, but we should respect the market to let them to make the decisions by themselves, not just by some kind of very strong and subjective decisions of the government. That is not reasonable.
Mm. Well, we're speaking with Dr. Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation, and also Yan Liang, Professor of Economics, Willamette University. And after a short break, we'll take a look at the U.S. economy. Stay with us.
Welcome. I'm Elaf Ellard, economics professor and member of the Data Science and AI Center at New York University, Shanghai. On the World Today program, you can find in-depth and impartial insight, as well as critical commentary on key trends in the Chinese economy, financial technology, business, and blockchain. To prepare for the world tomorrow, join me on World Today.
You are listening to Biz Today. I'm Zhao Yang in Beijing. The U.S. economy added more than 300,000 jobs in March, well above expectations. And official data shows that the unemployment rate fell to 3.8% from 3.9% in February. And meanwhile, the consumer price index rose 3.5% in March, marking an acceleration for inflation. So, Yan, first of all, how do you read the U.S. job, you know, figures in March? And what does it say about the U.S. job market and the economy as a whole?
Right. So I think the U.S. economy is in a quite sweet spot at this point. So you mentioned that job creation has reached 303,000 in March, and that is an upward improvement from the 275,000 job creation back in January. So that brought the unemployment rate down from 3.9% to now 3.8%. In the meantime, yes, inflation started to edge up a little bit, you know, from 3.2% back in February now to 3.5%. And what we're seeing is, you know, shelter, motor vehicle, insurance, medical care, apparel, and personal care. Those are some of the areas that registered the highest increase in prices. But still, you know, the 3.5% inflation rate is much lower than, you know, the peak back in 2022 in the summer, that it's 9%. So in that sense, I think, you know, inflation rate is tolerable at this point. And then job creation is healthy. We're also seeing the wage growth rate start to slow down. So that means even though we're adding more jobs, it doesn't seem that wage growth is going to put a lot of pressure on inflation. So the wage growth now is 4.1% in March. That is down from 4.3% back in February. But, you know, we're seeing really small growth in terms of the so-called real wage that increased only by 0.6% in March. And this is also, I think, important to put in the context that in the past 2 years, the workers' wage growth not kept up with inflation. So the workers are really just trying to right now catch up with them, the real earning growth. Mm. Now, that said, I think, you know, this economic picture will simply, you know, postpone the Fed's rate cuts. I think now many of the investors and analysts do not believe that the Fed is going to cut three times at all this year. Some argue it would be twice, hopefully in September and December. Others would say it's likely that the Fed is not going to have interest cut at all this year. And so I think that remains really uncertain in terms of if, you know, the rates are kept high, what that means to the U.S. economy and also for the global economy, because I think all central banks in the world are really watching what the Fed's next move is. And so I think that would have tremendous ramifications for their own economies and also for global economies as well.
Mm. So, Dr. Zhou, so how do you read these latest figures about the U.S. economy? Actually, for jobs, which sectors create more jobs in the U.S.? And also those big name companies like IBM, Google, Microsoft, like Amazon, they all have announced plans for cut this year. So how do you explain that? And will the layoff continue?
Actually, you know, in the past several years, especially last year, we see the artificial intelligence has put a very big impact on the global market. I mean, not only from the innovation sectors, but also for the traditional sectors. We see there are many strikes happened in the United States and also in other countries. I think that from the research of IMF, it said that when we are talking about the impact of the artificial intelligence on the employment, you may find that it is more obvious in the developed economies than in the developing countries and emerging economies. So I would say the United States will be one of the examples if we go in to observe that. Because of the usage of the artificial intelligence, it has changed the balance of the companies and changed even some of the strategies of the companies. The companies you mentioned, the Google, the Apple, and some of the giants, they are going to use the technology to replace some of the people. Actually, it's a really big impact in the supply and demand of those people. Well, if you're looking at the United States market, the stock market, when the message just be released, you know, the stock market went down because many of the investors don't think that the Fed will make a short-term, decisions to decrease the rates. So actually, these are really some of the structural problems for United States to deal with, and many of the companies are not so ready to be prepared for that. And I don't think that even other countries, because U.S. are one of the centers in the world about the supply chains, about different kind of innovation-based ideas, I think that will spread also to other countries. So I mean, that is a kind of problem that the government should be very cautious about. How can we dealing with the changes? How can we support the companies and even the sectors or even the whole industries to transform from the traditional one into a new one that should be based on the smoothly or not so many impact on the people? Because if we don't have many, pay attention to those problems, the people will feel more hurt about that.
Mm-hmm. So, Yan, so do you agree with Dr. Zhou about, how will the AI impact on the job market?
Right. I think the impact of AI right now on jobs are still not as prominent, I think, as it will be in the, medium term. What we're seeing job creation right now a lot are in the education and healthcare services, retail trade, government sector, and some manufacturing and so on. And I think you mentioned some of the tech sectors have been laying off. I think they are just riding this big cycle. If you remember, the tech industries has really expanded a lot right before the COVID and also during COVID because, work from home and a lot of the demands for technology and telecommunications and so on that have really created a boom, so to speak, in the tech industry. So now I think there is a revelation that they have expanded too much. And so you start to see the cuts and so on. But definitely, I think for forward-looking investors in the tech sector, they are seeing, how AI is going to affect their industries, right? If, AI can write codes, do we need so many computer engineers, computer programmers and so on and so forth. But I think for the most part, the job creation has been quite robust, partly because some of these industrial policies that we talked about. And part also, I think, has to do with the really expansionary fiscal policy. As you may know, with the high interest rates and with the high government debt, the federal government is actually projected to pay about $800 billion of interest to the private sector bondholders. And so that, serves as a big stimulus, as a matter of fact, to the economy. Now, there's always the question about, these kinds of handing money to the rich is very regressive in terms of income distribution. There's also the word about, how much the debt ceiling is going to, again, create, fiscal problems. And then you would have major cuts in some of the, federal spendings and so on and so forth.
Mm. And Dr. Zhou, so how do you think will the job and CPI figures impact the inflationary pressures and the thinking of the central banks moving forward on possible rate cuts?
Yeah, actually, that is what the Fed is trying to look at when they are trying to make the decision on whether to rising or to lowering the rates. They may look at employment and also about the inflation. So they were trying to combine these two indicators. But, United States is such a big country. They have different scenarios in different regions. So when they are trying to make some decisions, they are going to make it maximized by the benefits and lower the impact of the rate change on the market. When we're talking about the monetary policies, we see that when they are having a very high rate, it is maybe more prominent if they are going to make some changes. But if they are falling in the so-called the liquidity traps, it may be not so effective for them to use the monetary policies. Mm-hmm. So actually, nowadays, we see the market is really expecting the Fed to change its policies because the United States government have to pay a lot of interest to the market with such a high interest rate. So for the debt issue, for the debt consideration, maybe the world and also many of the emerging economies are suffering from the very high interest rate. rate.
So, yeah, actually, after all these latest figures, the market expects the first rate cut has been, you know, pushed further down the road, and it may come in September, not in June or July. And speculations that there could be even no rate cut this year has been growing. So how likely will that happen? And if so, how will it impact the global financial or capital market?
Right. So I think that really is a trillion-dollar question, if the Fed is going to cut the rates at all this year, or if so, when will be the first time and how many times they will cut. I think right now the market opinion, it's pretty divided. I think still most of the people believe that there will be at least one cut this year, likely in September, if not in December. Now, in terms of the impact, I think is going to be tremendous. There are many different reasons for that. One is, as I just mentioned, you know, when you have rate hike, on the one hand, you do have this regressive income transfer from the federal government to the bondholders, and that's good for the U.S. economy. But I think in the long term, this is not going to be conducive to some of the long-term investments because the rates are so high. You know, some of the investors, when they are thinking about, you know, projects, down the road, they will be hesitant, right, to really invest in the productive sector. And also, I think for the rest of the world, this is definitely going to be problematic. For example, African countries, especially low-income countries, many of them are struggling of paying, you know, foreign debt. And so when the interest rate remains high, that means they're going to have to pay more on the debt service. And so that really, you know, cripple their ability to spend anything on the domestic needs, right? Be it healthcare, education, or climate mitigation. So that could be a really tremendous problem. And even for countries that are not facing a lot of the external debt, for countries like New Zealand, for example, they just experienced a double dip recession. It will be very good for them to expand their monetary policy and lower the interest rates. But I know that the central bank has been really hesitant because they do not want to make the first move before the U.S. government, U.S. Fed actually lowers its interest rate. Thailand is in similar situations. There are just so many countries. They have reservations about cutting rates before the Fed does it, because if it creates large interest rate differentials, this is going to depreciate their currency. This could trigger some kind of capital outflows and so on and so forth. So I think the Fed's interest rate policy is actually very consequential for the rest of the world.
Mm. Well, we're speaking with Yan Liang, Professor of Economics, Willamette University, and also Dr. Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation. And that's all the time we have for this edition of Biz Today. I'm Zhao Yang in Beijing. Thank you so much for listening.